You're listening to BFBS broadcasting from London.
We present Ian Carmichael as Lord Peter Wimsey in Murder Must Advertise by Dorothy L. Sayers, adapted for radio by Alistair Beaton, with Alan Cuthbertson as Chief Inspector Parker, Beth Morris as Diane de Momery, Edward de Souza as Mr. Tallboy, and Brian Wilde as Mr. Garrett. Episode 3, Unsentimental Masquerade of a Harlequin.
Lord Peter Wimsey has joined the staff of a London advertising agency in an attempt to unravel the mystery surrounding the death of young Victor Dean. Known only to the other members of staff as Mr. Breeden, Wimsey's investigations are proceeding as planned until he is informed that his brother-in-law, Chief Inspector Charles Parker, has been attacked. It is clearly a case of attempted murder. It is also clear that the intended victim was not Inspector Parker, but Lord Peter Wimsey himself. The attacker, however, has left a clue behind.
Well, Charles, it might have been worse. You may have a broken collarbone, but we've got three lines to go on. The people at Pym's Publicity, who knew that this place was the address I had given to the firm, the people who heard all about me and my catapult, and, of course, the bloke who's lost his pencil.
And you're quite sure that pencil isn't on the market yet?
Quite sure. Could only have come from Pym's. I say, what a shock it must have been for whoever it was when I turned up this morning without so much as a black eye. You didn't manage to mark him, did you, Charles?
Afraid not. I got a clutch on his beastly throat, but he was all muffled up.
Ah, you did that badly, Charles. You should have socked him one. But I forgive you. I wonder if our friend will have another shot at me.
Not at this address, I hope.
Ah! Now I understand.
What?
Why nobody fainted at the sight of me this morning. He must have had a torch with him. He knocks you down, turns on the torch to see if you're properly dead, and he realizes he slugged the wrong man. Then he spots Pamela Dean's letter. But why would he have taken it? Did he know the writing, I wonder? When was it delivered?
Well, the 9:30 post, of course.
Suppose when he came in to look for my flat, he saw the letter in the box and recognized who it was from. That opens a wide field of speculation and possibly even offers another motive.
Wimsey, all this speculation is sending my temperature up.
Look here, old lad, I really am frightfully sorry you copped that packet that was meant for me. It's perfectly damnable luck, and I'm dashed thankful it wasn't worse.
But what kind of irregularity could be going on in Pym's that would make it worthwhile doing away with Victor Dean and then trying to do the same with you?
Ah, now we're coming to that. Did you know, for instance, that young Dean used to hang around with the de Momery crowd?
Ah, sinning above his station in life, eh?
Very much so. But you know Diane de Momery. She gets more kicks out of corrupting the bourgeois. She enjoys the wrestle with their little consciences.
Was Diane Dean's mistress?
Oh, must have been. Now, Willis claims that young Dean wanted to let that crowd corrupt his sister, Pamela, as well. But I doubt that.
Who is Willis?
I beg your pardon, Charles. Willis is a young man who foams at the mouth if you mention the late Victor Dean. Willis was once Victor Dean's dearest friend, is in love with Pamela Dean, is furiously jealous of me, thinks I'm tarred with the same brush as Victor Dean, and dogs my footsteps with the incompetent zeal of 50 Watsons. He writes copy about face cream and corsets, is the son of a provincial draper, was educated at a grammar school, and wears, I deeply regret to say, a double-breasted waistcoat. That is the most sinister thing about him. Except that he admits to having been in the lavatory when Victor Dean fell downstairs, and the lavatory is the next step to the roof.
What was Willis's row with Dean?
Well, it transpires that Willis was in love with Dean's sister. And Willis, being a boob, talked to sister like a Dutch uncle because Dean had taken her to one of Diane de Momery's hot parties. Sister told Willis to go and bury himself. Willis then threatened Dean that he would shoot him like a dog. His very words, I'm told.
Willis appears to think in cliches.
Well, of course he does. That's why he writes such good corset copy. Anyhow, there it was. Dean and Willis are daggers drawn for 3 months. Then Dean falls downstairs. Now, another problem with Victor Dean is that he was pulling down £6 a week at Pym's. How does one manage to run with the de Momery crowd on £300 a year?
Blackmail. Dean is looking round for a spot of extra income, and he discovers somebody at Pym's doing something he shouldn't. The head cashier cooking the accounts or something. So he says, if you don't square me, I'll tell Pym, and starts to write a letter. Probably, you know, he never meant that letter to get to Pym at all. It was just a threat. The other man stops him for the moment by paying up something on account. Then he thinks, this is hopeless. I better slug the little beast, so he slugs him. And there you are.
Simple as that?
Probably not. Well, it'll do you no end of good, Peter, to have a really difficult case for once. When you struggled for a bit with a death that might have been caused by anybody for any imaginable motive, you may be less sniffy and superior about the stray murders all over the country that the police so notoriously failed to avenge. I hope it will be a lesson to you.
Thank you, Charles. I will try to profit by it. In the meantime, I'll go on gulling the public and be in Mr. Breeden to be heard of at your address.
Yes, and keep clear of that De Momery lot.
Yes, absolutely. He's a bad lot, that De Momery girl. I'm hoping to meet her tonight, incidentally, so I can let you know for certain.
Peter, quite apart from your morals, which alarm me, how did you get into that gang? I should have thought they'd as soon have taken up with the Chief Commissioner himself.
I am going incog. A fancy dress party, don't you know? And you needn't worry about my morals. All these young women get incapably drunk before the evening's half over.
Exactly. And what's the disguise to be?
Harlequin. Yeah, with a mask. A clever idea, what?
Dive! Dive in! I dare you to! Dive in!
I say, who is that fellow in the Harlequin costume?
Not a clue, old boy. But if he dives off that fountain, he's a goner.
Gosh! Do you really think he's going to do it?
Dive, Harlequin! Dive!
Oh, shut up, Diane. It's too shallow. He'll break his neck.
You be quiet. He shall dive. I want him to. He'll go to hell.
No, I say.
You wouldn't dare do it, but he will. Come on, Harlequin! Dive! Oh, you're marvellous. You're marvellous. Take me home, Harlequin. I adore you.
Come on, then. Run, run. And let them catch us if they can.
Harlequin, would you behave like an idiot for diving into fountains?
My dear Mr. Momery, one must be different. I am always different. That is why, my dear young lady, I am the pursued and not the pursuer. You may say it's a cheap way of producing the effect, and so it is, but it's good enough for gin-soaked minds. On such as you, if you will pardon my saying so, subtlety would be wasted.
Well, Harlequin, if that's how you feel, why did you have to whisk me away from that perfectly wild party?
To please myself. Which is the only reason you would admit for doing anything.
I could see you better without that damn mask.
And love me better, perhaps.
Perhaps.
Then I'm safer with it on.
Oh.
I hear your lovers have a knack of coming to bad ends. Like Victor Dean.
The little rotter. That wasn't anything to do with me.
Wasn't it?
Fell down a staircase or something, didn't he?
So he did. But why?
I haven't the faintest idea.
Haven't you? I thought you might have. Why did you send Victor Dean about his business?
Because he was a silly little bore, and just like all the rest.
You like them to be different?
I like everything to be different.
And when you find them different, you try to make them all alike. Do you know anybody who is different?
Yes. You're different.
If I come down to your level, I shall be just like all the rest.
Try it.
I know when I'm well off. You can only go down and down.
Are you trying to insult me?
Yes, but it's very difficult. Tell me about Victor Dean. How did you pick him up?
We all went out one night to some frightful sort of suburban dancing place. We thought it would be such a scream.
And was it?
No, it was rather dull, really. But he was there, and he fell for me, and I thought he was rather a pet. That's all.
A simple story in words of one syllable. How long was he your pet?
Oh, about 6 months. But he wasn't any fun. He was all wet, Harlequin, darling.
My child, you are telling this story very badly. You made him drink, and it upset his little tummy. You made him play high, and he said he couldn't afford it. You tried to make him take drugs, and he didn't like it. Anything else?
He was a little beast, Harlequin. Really, he was. He was out for what he could get.
Aren't you?
Me? I'm terribly generous. I gave him everything he wanted. I'm like that when I'm fond of anybody.
He took what he could get, but didn't spend it like a gentleman.
That's it. Do you know he actually called himself a gentleman? Wouldn't that make you laugh? Like the Middle Ages, isn't it? Ladies and gentlemen. He said we needn't think he wasn't a gentleman because he worked in an office. Too mirth-making, Harlequin, darling, wasn't it? Oh, Harlequin, listen, I'll tell you something funny. One night, I took Victor Dean to a party at Todd's place on the river.
A Todd?
Todd Milligan. Well, I introduced Victor to Todd. I said, this is Victor Dean, and he's a gentleman, and he works for Pym's Publicity. Todd said, oh, you're the chap, are you? And looked too utterly murderous. And afterwards, he asked me, just like you, how I got hold of Victor. Well, that's queer. Did Todd send you out here to ask me?
No one ever sends me anywhere. I go where I like.
Well, then why do you want to know all about Victor Dean?
Too mystery-making, ain't it? What did Milligan say to Dean?
Oh, nothing much, but he told me to string him along, and afterwards, quite suddenly, he told me to give him the push.
And you did, as you were told, like a good girl.
I was fed up with Victor anyhow, and it doesn't do to get wrong with Todd.
No, he might cut off supplies, mightn't he? Where does he get it from?
Cocaine, do you mean?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
No, I don't suppose you do. And you can't get him to tell you either, can you? Not with all your charms.
Oh, Todd doesn't give anything away. He's a dirty swine. I loathe him. I'd do anything to get away from Todd. He knows too much. And besides, he's got the stuff. Lots of people have tried to chuck Todd, but they always go back again. Every Friday and Saturday.
That's when he hands it out, is it?
Mostly. But you weren't there earlier tonight, were you? He'd run short of the stuff or something. There was a hellish row, so I dashed off in the car and then you appeared. You aren't one of Todd's regular lot, are you?
Not at present.
Do you want to be? Because don't. I'll get the stuff for you if you want, but Todd's a beast. You'd better keep clear of him.
Are you warning me for my own good?
Yes, I am.
What devotion. Why don't you cut loose from Todd?
I can't.
Afraid of him?
Not so much of him. It's the people behind him. Todd's afraid, too. He'd never let me go. He'd kill me first.
How fascinating. I think I must get to know Mr. Milligan.
You'd end up by being afraid, too.
Should I? Well, there's a kick in being afraid, you know.
I could show you how to get a kick out of life.
Could you?
Try and see.
What are you good for to me?
I am beautiful.
Not so beautiful as you were. In 5 years' time, you'll be ugly.
5 years? I wouldn't want you for 5 years.
I wouldn't want you for 5 minutes.
Well, what next?
Nothing. I shall take you home.
What's happened?
We're home. Where's your latchkey?
Here. Kiss me. Take that mask off.
I'll run along in. There's a policeman thinking we look rather disreputable.
Aren't you coming in?
No.
Well, goodbye then.
Goodbye, Diane.
Ah, good evening, officer.
Evening, sir.
Moffat, you will never get promotion. If you don't know me, you should know the car.
Oh, good Lord, your lordship. I beg your pardon. I didn't somehow expect to see you here.
And not so much of your lordship either. Somebody might be listening. You on your beat?
Just going home, sir.
Yeah, jump in and I'll drive you there.
Thank you, my lord.
Ever see a fellow called Milligan around here?
Major Todd Milligan?
Hmm.
Yeah, now and then. Oh, he's a bad hat, he is, if ever there was one. Runs that place down by the river. Mixed up with that big drug gang as Mr. Parker's after. We could pull him in any day, but he's not the real big noise.
Isn't he?
Oh, no, my lord. This car's a treat, ain't she? Shouldn't think there's much catch as you on the road. No, what Mr. Parker wants is to get him to lead us to the top man of all. But there don't seem to be much chance of it. Cunning as weasels they are. Don't suppose he knows himself who the other fella is.
How's it work, Moffat?
Well, my lord, as far as we've been told, the stuff is brought in from the coast once or twice a week and run up to London. We've had a try catching it on the way more than once. Well, that is to say, Mr. Parker's special squad have, but they've always given us the slip. Then it'll be taken somewhere, but where we don't know, and distributed out again to the big distributors. From them, it goes to all kinds of places. We could lay hands on it, but, well, what's the use? It'd only be in another place next week.
And where does Milligan come into it?
Well, we think he's one of the high-up distributors, my lord. He hands it out of that house of his and other places.
In the place where you found me, for instance?
Well, that's one of them.
But the point is, where does Milligan get his supplies?
Ah, that's it, my lord.
Can't you follow him and find out?
Ah, but he don't fetch it for himself, my lord. As others does that. And you see, if we was to open his parcels and search his tradesmen and so on, they'd just strike him off their list, and we'd be back where we was before.
So you would. Do you happen to know how often he gives parties at that house of his on the river?
Oh, most evenings, I'm told, my lord. Seems to keep open house-like.
Ah. Well, you tell him to keep an eye open on Friday and Saturday nights, Moffat.
Fridays and Saturdays, my lord?
Those are the nights when things happen.
Is that so, my lord?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm much obliged to you. We didn't know that. That's a good tip, that is. Oh, if you'll drop me at the next corner, my lord, that'll do me a treat.
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid I've took your lordship out of your way.
Not a bit of it, Moffat, not a bit. Very glad to have seen you. Oh, and by the way, you have not seen me.
Hmm?
Not a question of morals, you understand, but I fancy that Major Milligan might not approve of my visiting that particular house.
Ah, oh, that's all right, my lord. Not being on duty at the time, I ain't bound to put in a report. Good night, my lord, and thank you.
Good night, Moffat. Morning, Mr. Garrett.
Good morning, Mr. Breeden.
Good morning, Mr. Breeden.
What's up with Tallboy this morning? Looking pretty glum, don't you think?
Well, the way he shoved past Miss Roster and me in the lift this morning.
Treats me the same way. I suppose he thinks I'm not worth talking to just because he's been to a public school and I haven't.
Public school? Well, first I've heard of it. What public school?
Oh, he was at Dumbleton.
Dumbleton? I don't think Dumbleton's a public school within the meaning of the Act.
Isn't it? Well, you've had a college education, Mr. Breeden. What schools do you call public schools?
Eton. Oh, and Harrow.
And Rugby?
Oh, no, that's a railway junction. And I've heard there's a decentish sort of place at Winchester, if you're not too particular.
I once met a man who'd been to Marlborough.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Oh, Mr. Garrett, Mr. Tallboy says, can you go and see him right away? He doesn't look too happy.
Oh, dear. Ah, you wanted to see me, Tallboy?
Now, look here, Gavin. I understand that you altered the new track's headline last night after I'd gone home. I should like to know what right you think you have to go around changing other people's copy. The sheer impertinence of it leaves me absolutely flabbergasted.
Listen, Tallboy, I was doing you a favour. The Morning Gazette rang at 6 o'clock in an absolute tizzy about the new track's headline. I am considerably older than you, Tallboy, and in my day, a group manager would have been ashamed to leave the building before ascertaining that all was well with his advertisement for the next day's paper. How you came to let such an advertisement pass in the first place is beyond my understanding.
What was wrong with it?
Well, the headline ran, "Are you taking too much out of yourself?"
And what's wrong with that?
Nothing. But taken in conjunction with the picture, it did lay itself open to an unfortunate interpretation. You couldn't be contacted by phone, and there was only half an hour to do it in, so I changed it to overwork and overworry waste nerve power. I was rather pleased with it, actually.
You were rather pleased with it, were you?
For heaven's sake, poor boy, don't make such a row.
And another thing, Garrett. When you were hugger-muggering around my desk last night, did you have the unprintable bloody impertinence to interfere with my private belongings?
Poor boy, I've got a splitting headache.
I don't care a highly coloured damn if you've got a headache or not. There was an envelope in my desk last night with £50 in it, and it's gone, and Mrs. Crump says that she saw you faffing about among my papers.
I have your £50 here. I put it away safely for you, and I must say, Torboy, that I consider it extremely thoughtless of you to leave your property about for the charwoman to find. It's not fair. You should have more consideration than to put temptation in people's way. And I did not rummage about in your desk, as you suggest. I merely looked for the pull of the new tracks half double, and when I was closing the desk, this envelope fell out upon the floor.
You mean to tell me that you had the all-fired cheek to take my money away to your own damned room?
In your own interest.
Interest be damned, Garrett! Why the devil couldn't you leave it in a pigeonhole and not be so blasted interfering?
You do not realize...
I realize this, Garrett, that you're a superannuated interfering idiot. What the devil did you want to come poking your blasted nose in for?
Really, Mr. Torboy?
What business is it of yours, anyway?
It was anybody's business who had the welfare of the firm at heart.
I don't want you to teach me my job.
Pardon me, I think you do.
Anyway, what's that got to do with it? The point is, you stick your nose into my private affairs.
I did not. The envelope fell out.
That's a bloody lie.
Pardon me. It is the truth.
Don't keep saying pardon me like a bloody kitchen maid.
Really, Torboy, I think I ought to receive an apology.
You? You? Why the hell couldn't you have had the decency to ring me and tell me?
You weren't at home.
How do you know? Did you try?
No, but I knew you were out because I saw you in Southampton Row on my way out.
You saw me in Southampton Row and you hadn't the ordinary common decency to get hold of me and tell me what you've been after? Upon my word, Garrett, I believe you jolly well meant to get me into a row. And collar the cash for yourself, too, I shouldn't wonder.
How dare you suggest any such thing?
And all your rot about consideration for the charwomen, it's sheer damned hypocrisy. Of course I thought one of them had taken it. I said to the head cleaner...
You accused her?
I didn't accuse her. I told her I had missed £50. And fortunately, she'd seen you at my desk. Otherwise, I suppose I should never have heard anything more about my money.
You have no right to say that.
I have a damn sight more right to say it than you had to steal my money.
Are you calling me a thief?
Yes, Garrett, I am.
And I call you a scoundrel, Torboy. An insolent scoundrel. And I say that if you came by the money honestly, which I doubt, sir, which I very much doubt... What do you want, Breeden?
I say sorry to butt in and all that, but Hanky's compliments, and he says, would you mind talking a little more quietly? He's got a client next door.
I'll take my envelope, thank you. All right, Garrett. I shan't forget your kind interference.
Oh, dear.
Anything up?
Please, go away.
All righty, huh?
Oh, here's Mr. Breeden. Coffee, Mr. Breeden?
Mm, oh, hello. Oh, yes, please, rather.
I say, have you heard the latest?
Mm?
Old Garrett pinched 50 quid off Tallboy.
You don't say. Gosh, tell me quickly.
Well, somebody sent Mr. Tallboy £50 in a registered envelope.
I wish people would send me £50. Isn't registered envelopes?
I say, mm-hmm. Have you heard about Tallboy?
Lost 50 quid in an envelope, I'm told, Miss Meatyard.
Oh, well, anyway, apparently it was in his desk and he forgot about it.
Yeah, catch me forgetting about 50 quid, what?
50 pounds or so is nothing to Mr. Tallboy, obviously.
I say.
What?
How on earth did Tallboy come to have that kind of money in the first place?
In that episode of Murder Must Advertise, the parts were played as follows. Lord Peter Wimsey, Ian Carmichael. Chief Inspector Parker, Alan Cuthbertson. Diane de Momery, Beth Morris. Mr. Tallboy, Edward D'Souza. Mr. Garrett, Brian Wilde. Miss Meatyard, Francis Jeter. Miss Rossiter, Joanna Wake. PC Moffat, Gordon Clyde. Murder Must Advertise was adapted by Alastair Beaton from the book by Dorothy L. Sayers. The programme was produced by Martin Fisher.